From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. This time, it's not the Martians invading. The new truth is more terrifying. War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to you all. I'm John Helmer, and George Eliason isn't yet able to say I'm George Eliason because the line to Lugansk, to the Donbas, where George is based, is currently playing up, and we can't hear him yet. We hope that George will come on as we go along. We have today a guest who will, Professor Marcello Ferrara de Noli, who will come on after the first break and talk to us about Sweden and about where he teaches and explain to us why Sweden, like Norway, like Finland, have joined NATO and are among the most active warriors against Russia on the Ukraine battlefield. But more of that in 20 minutes. In the first segment, what we try to do, George and I, is to give you a glimpse of what's really about to happen based on our reading, our analysis of the breaking news and of the sources we have. Now, I've dropped the intro. The intro, let me remind you, is that in front of this microphone, you won't be hearing armchair generals and think tankers paid to run propaganda lines for NATO and the Biden administration. This won't be the hour tonight, today, or this afternoon, depending on where you are, for rehashing what you've already read and what you've already seen. Our microphone is fitted with a special filter to keep the propaganda and the false expertise out. We aren't a crosstalk of reporters pushing their bylines and egos. We aren't the BBC hard talk, which is in fact soft-scented confectionery manufactured at the Foreign Office and MI6. So this is the hour when you'll be able to hear the news breaking from the war fronts throughout Europe and hear fresh and original analysis of what the breaking news means. So sit tight, here goes. 3 points to kick off. What did President Vladimir Putin mean in his restatement of the war aim after the Ukraine drones hit Moscow? Let me quote you what he said, and then let's try to understand what he meant and whether this represents a significant change in Russian war aim. President Putin said, quotes, after Ukrainian drones had landed in Moscow, we all had to respond by launching the special military operation. We are striking at the territory of Ukraine, but with long-range precision weapons at military infrastructure facilities only, either at ammunition or fuel and lubricants warehouses used for combat operations. We have talked about the possibility of striking at decision-making centers. Of course, the headquarters of the Ukrainian military intelligence is one of them, and a strike at this target was carried out 2 or 3 days ago. Now, what does Putin mean by long-range precision targeting? Let me try to explain. Here's the military website, Colonel Kassab, on both a blog and a Telegram account, on how the missile operation against the GUR, the Ukrainian military intelligence headquarters, was actually carried out. I'm quoting what Boris Rozhin, who's Colonel Kassab, had to say. 2 days before the missile strike on the GUR building, Kiev was attacked by drones. In total, about 40 of them were recorded, some used to open the camouflage and reveal the air defense positions around the GUR. According to some reports, after a massive drone raid on May 27-28, a significant part of Kiev's air defense ammunition was spent, and by the morning of May 30, the calculations of the air defense complexes were waiting for the delivery of new ammunition, but were not ready to fire. In other words, what Rogozin is saying, and I can't verify it independently, the Russian attack on Kiev was not only at long distance and precision directed, it was based after massive drone attacks were used to expend Ukrainian ammunition and identify the air defense positions. What then happened, according to Rogozin, was that one of two types of missiles, not usually identified, a naval weapon called the P-800 Onyx from a Bastion coastal complex with a range of 300 to 400 kilometers, fired from the water, hit the GUR building. The other possibility is that there was an X-35U or P-800 which was fired, or maybe some combination. In other words, according to Rogozin, new types of missile, Russian missile, were used to attack GUR, and more than one of them. What does this level of precision in reporting what happened, and also in striking the GUR building, mean? First of all, strategically, what it means is that there isn't a target in the Ukraine which Russian military intelligence can't identify well in advance. Second, each precision attack as such is preceded by drone attacks. Now, when the Ukrainian press, amplified by every Western newspaper you can think of, open up against drones identifying exaggerated numbers or real numbers of those shot down, what's really happened is the reverse. For every alleged shoot down amplified in the London, New York, or other press, every one of those has revealed a firing position, an air defense position. And then the calculation is entered into the precision targeting of the missile attack. But what's happened to the advanced US air defenses for the GUR building? You can imagine, and it's true, that the Ukrainian Patriot missile battery, the second of them, the one that wasn't destroyed earlier in May, was unable to protect a major strategic target like Ukrainian military intelligence. It also appears from Russian bloggers, not confirmed outside of Moscow, but not denied in the United States or in London, that no significant Patriot or NASAM anti-aircraft or anti-missile missile system effectively protected the GUR building. So when President Putin says we're going to continue precision attacks, he's actually saying there isn't a target the Russian side can't identify, and there isn't a Ukrainian air defense system, including the most advanced US and NATO systems, that can protect those targets. Now, this is a very serious disadvantage strategically for the Ukrainian and NATO side. To the extent that this is the battlefield reality, the question of whether there'll be a Russian offensive is delayed. All the Russian side is now saying is general patience is at work here with highly developed intelligence and precision targeting. There is no hurry for the Russian side to expose either ground forces or air forces, manned air forces, to the battlefield, at least not yet. General Patience, whom we've talked about before, having succeeded General Winter in command and control of Russian operations in the Ukraine, is fighting with a scalpel. When the regime is decapitated, as the GUR headquarters was this past week, and when or if it capitulates, then the cities in the east that have yet to change sides, Odessa, Nikolaev, and Kharkov, will decide for themselves which side to be on, the winning side or the losing side. And from the long history of Odessa, there's no doubt which side that city will be on when the Kiev regime fails to achieve even minimal survival. Now, how has President Zelensky replied to all of this in the last day or two? He's told the Wall Street Journal, which you can see in a breaking story in New York at the moment, in quotes, Zelensky, "In my opinion, as of today, we are ready to do it." What he means is ready to launch a counteroffensive, the counteroffensive. Well, what's that? We talked last week, George and I, of what the Ukrainian counteroffensive means, what the US signal that it's providing Ukrainian pilots in US supplied F-16s through other allies to enter the air battle over the Ukrainian battlefield. What Zelensky means is that the US and NATO with him are planning to launch a pretend Ukrainian attack on Russian targets, not drones dropped in Russian locations, not artillery shelling of the kind that's aimed at civilians in the Belgorod, Bryansk, and other regions along the northern Ukrainian border with Russia. What will happen, and we discussed this last week, is will happen under the camouflage of the Air Defender 23 exercise. That's the largest exercise or operation of NATO allied warplanes, aircraft, more than 220 of them, will take to the air starting June 12, commanded from Ramstein Air Base in Germany, supported by NATO and US AWACS, other electronic warning and surveillance aircraft, and NATO refueling tankers from Germany, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and the Black Sea. It's a massive operation. It begins on June 12 and runs till June 25. When we discussed it last week, we've seen no significant media pickup yet among the retired US military and CIA experts on Russia, whom you can watch on the blogs. Although Paul Craig Roberts, that leftover Reagan administration appointee, did tell his readers to watch out for this warning. So does this camouflaged Ukrainian counteroffensive, in reality a US-NATO one, in the middle of June, if it materializes, can it be made to look like a Ukrainian offensive? That's a question we're not going to answer yet. We're not able to answer yet. What we do want to urge you to understand is what's coming. We have to go to break in a second or two. And one of the things that we'll be talking about with our guest, Marcello Ferrada Nannoli, is how it turns out that Sweden, which is also participating in a current military exercise with aircraft, the Gripen jet fighter, that is, it's being discussed, it will supply the Ukraine. In the current NATO exercise, Sweden, Finland, Norway, and the USS General Gerald Ford, the aircraft carrier, are participating in what's called the Arctic Challenge 23 exercise. We're going to try to understand how Sweden, Norway, and Finland play a particularly aggressive role against Russia in this war, and why it turns out that a country like Sweden, proclaimed to be neutral during World War II, has turned to become one of the most, in public opinion and in political orientation, one of the most hostile Russia war-fighting states in Western Europe. Let's go to break, then I'll introduce Marcello, and hopefully Georgia Larson will make it back on air when we come back.
TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Mike Pence, I still don't understand how he gets 5% in the polls. Forget January 6th, forget election. Just stick with Mike Pence and what he did with COVID and public health. He wrote his recent book where he literally announced, it declared in the book, that he helped get masks across America to make sure Americans were masked for our safety, with no hint of, oh, that may have been a mistake. He literally bragged about working, and that was working with 3M to get masks everywhere, to get those kids masked up, those kindergartners and toddlers. Let's mask them up for a few years. That ought to be good for their development, intellectual and speech habits. Then Mike Pence, in his book, his new autobiography, also wrote about how he bragged about how he got ventilators in hospitals, and every report coming out is how ventilators kill. It was one of the most ill-advised things. And that's fine if you thought he was doing something good at the time, but there's something called truth and accuracy. He should at least either ignore it now or admit it was a mistake. Not Mike Pence. Mike Pence also praised Fauci in the book. Mike Pence was at every vaccine and every lockdown press conference. Nary a word of complaint ever.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
You're listening to War of the Worlds with John Helmer and George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And John Helmer's back. That's me. George Eliason is still cut off in the Donbass. And I'm very happy to introduce our guest for today, Marcello Ferrata Donoli, who's speaking to us from Italy. But welcome to the show, the program, the broadcast, Marcello. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me in the show.
Can I ask you, by way of introduction, if you tell us, your name is clearly an Italian name, I guess, but you've been a professor in Sweden. Can you introduce yourself and help us understand how you came to be in Sweden and where you are now?
Well, my name is Marcello Ferrata Donoli. I was born in Chile of Italian ascendants. And in Sweden, I have been some years after the coup d'etat in Chile. I was born in Chile, but I've been in and out of Europe during several periods in my life, in Italy before, and then in England before the coup as well. It was my first exile due to the opposition, our organization, due to the Christian Democratic Government of Eduardo Frei that was in the late 60s. As I said, after the coup, I participated in the resistance against the military forces. I was imprisoned in Kirigin Island and the stadium, and I was expelled from Chile, and I went to Italy. And from Italy, my organization sent me to Sweden in order to take part of the activities to support the resistance of our organization against the military dictatorship in Chile. So in Sweden, I was in charge of the counterintelligence unit of the movement of the revolutionary left and also of the Junta de Coordinación Revolucionaria. And at that time, I was not having any passport. I was deprived of my papers from Chile. So I was traveling with the Geneva Convention refugee documents. And subsequently, I became Swedish citizen. Continue with my or recommence my academic career, and I study at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, which is the medical faculty of Sweden, and etc. I became later doctor of medicine in psychiatry, and I was a professor in Norway. After I've been in Harvard Medical School in a research fellowship, and also became professor in Sweden afterwards, and not in psychiatry, but in epidemiology, mainly in psychiatric epidemiology issues. So that's the reason why I've been in Sweden so long, for half a century, perhaps. But since my family comes originally from Italy, Genoa particularly, I have moved to Italy since also very many years ago, even before my retirement. So after my retirement, I continue working in Sweden, but living in Italy. And that's the reason why we are having this interview from here in the pre-Alpine region from Italy.
Thank you very much. It's a very distinguished and interesting career. May I ask you just to begin by way of introducing how Sweden must have changed from your point of view? In your writing, which I recommend to our listeners and will provide in the website backup that comes after the broadcast, links to some of the pieces that you'd like listeners to follow up with. You've long been an advocate of the political and military neutrality for Sweden, which was its official policy during World War II. Some people regard Sweden's neutrality in World War II as essentially a cover for trying to be on the winning side, initially with Germany, when Stockholm thought Germans would win, and then to switch to the Soviet Union and the Allies when Sweden thought Germany was finished. How do you explain the reverse direction Sweden has taken to become a NATO member and to do all of the things that we've seen, the anti-Russian things? They were complicit in some of the Novichok fabrications involving Alexei Navalny. They've been involved, as we now know, in the preparations for the Nord Stream bombings last year. And they are among the most active financiers of weapons deliveries to the Ukraine, to the extent that they're now negotiating the delivery of the Gripen fighter. Why has Sweden changed, or has it changed from your understanding?
Well, in the first place, I do not think that Sweden has behaved geopolitically as a proper neutral country, as comparing perhaps with the case of Switzerland, for instance, or Switzerland prior to the Ukraine-Russia conflict. During the World War II in Germany, essential metals needed by the industry, the Nazi industry, to continue the war, were provided by Sweden from mining in the north of Sweden. Troops and weaponry were passing the Swedish territory to reach Norway, even with the assistance of the Swedish state railway enterprises. So all that was favoring the transport of troops and weapons to be used later in the Operation Barbarossa against the Soviet Union. So how neutral was Sweden during that period? It's a matter of analysis and discussion. In my opinion, that was not neutrality according to what the international law is referring to. And then we have about perhaps one decade or more been using in Sweden a variety of euphemisms to describe the geopolitical stances of Sweden when there was not any longer possible, there was not tenable to defend the in quotation marks, the neutrality position of Sweden. So we started to talk about non-alignment instead. Because neutrality position in the fact was a flag I would not say the old social democrats, but at least the social democratic leader during the 60s and 70s, particularly Olof Palme. Olof Palme, he in my opinion, he really believed in the position of neutrality, the active neutrality, because of the benefits, not only that could give to Sweden, but also the benefit that Sweden could give to the cause of peace worldwide by, for instance, participating in or being a host for conferences for peace, mediating, you know, in different international conflicts, etc. So Sweden has that that position during this 60s and 70s. Olof Palme, he bravely opposed actively to the war in the in Vietnam, the American war in Vietnam, and he proactively gave solidarity to liberation movements, anti-colonialist movements in Africa, etc. You know, he also and in very energetic terms, he condemned the United States-backed coup of Pinochet in Chile of 1973. Many Chileans were accepted as refugees
in Sweden. Was assassinated and is the neutrality, are the things he represented, the views you've just expressed, now as dead as regrettably Palme is?
Well, but that is the point, that it is not Palme himself that has been assassinated in Sweden. It was also assassinated the concept of social profiled social democratic doctrine. You know, after Palme came another prime minister, and after that prime minister, the social democratic movement, who was very forceful and very powerful in Sweden, admitted in their ideology the neoliberalism, and all of that changed then in Sweden. That is the main change, you know. The change in the foreign policy of Sweden follows the change in the system of political governance in Sweden. Very many institutions known internationally as being protecting the interest of the workers, or the students, etc., were one after one dismantled Sweden. So what we have in Sweden then, it's at the same time, you know, with this phenomena of abandoning the so-called neutrality, they were also abandoning the essence of the political system governing Sweden during the, for instance, the times of Olof Palme, and also long before. So the penetration of in the political making of Sweden by the ideas of neoliberalism and the lobbying exercised in Sweden by representatives of NATO and the Western countries, those things might explain also the change in the position of Sweden. So we have this situation as well.
Do Swedes, you've been a professor, among other things, of psychiatry, and as you explained, is there the hatred for Russians, Russophobia, among Swedish people that, for example, we've talked about here, that's very obvious in Oslo, Norway? When I'm looking at opinion polls to prepare for your coming on, I can see a level of attention paid to the invasion talk when the beginning of the special operation began. The attention paid by Swedes to what was happening was among the highest in Europe. Among the European people, the Swedes seem to lead in proportion more than other Europeans for the perceived risks to their own country from Russia. What explains, if that's, I mean, I understand that opinion polling can be tendentious, it can be leading, the publication of opinion polls can be manipulated, but from your experience, is there a level of hatred of Russia and Russians among Swedes, and why?
Well, we have a phenomena going on in the whole European Union. The issue of Russophobia, you know, this is has been presented as a in combination with the. The new onset of fascist movements in Europe. To which extent is the Swedish Russophobia, and I have to explain the difference between the position of the governing elites, the cultural elites, and the people. I take that later, but whether there is such a difference between the attitude of Sweden or the Swedish people about the Russians differently to other countries in the European Union, like in Germany, for instance, or in Poland, or in Latvia, or Estonia, etc.
Well, how about Italy? What, you're living in Italy. You've got family links to Italy. You teach and work in Sweden. Can you compare the levels of Russophobia and personal animosity, racism, you might say, towards Russians in Sweden compared to Italy?
Well, I will answer to that, but let me explain that. In difference to Sweden, Italy has not had any conflict, direct war, you know, with Russia. If we accept what happened during the Napoleonic Wars, but Sweden and Russia, they have been in wars, you know, at least main wars, at least 8-9 wars since many centuries. So there is a history of not only of conflictive situation between Russia and Sweden, but, you know, huge territories are being taken by Russia or vice versa, you know, during centuries. To give you one example, Finland belonging to Sweden before, but then after Sweden lost the war to Russia, Russia could take Finland as a protectorate, and with the years Finland became independent by its own. So this animosity, it is also rooted, you know, in old conflicts and Russia invading part of Sweden and Sweden, you know, waging wars against Russia in territories what now is Ukraine, for instance, the famous Battle of Poltava happening in the 1800s, and that was the battle that Karl the 12th lost, and that was one of the hallmarks that demonstrate the losing of Sweden of its empire in the Baltic. So Italy has not had that situation, Berlin situation with Russia. I don't say that that's the only thing that would explain the certain animosity of Swedes. But in Italy, you know, the majority of the people in Italy, and that has been established in two different polls this year, the majority oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine. At the same time, we have a government in Italy led by Prime Minister Prime Minister, member of the Fratelli d'Italia, which is classified as a far right political party, and then she from her government, Giorgia Meloni is the name of the Prime Minister. She has been pushing anyway, you know, the sending of weapons to Ukraine. So in this opposition to the weapon sending, there is also a question whether we in Italy should consider Russia and the Russians as enemies, as in other countries are considered. But one thing
can
is
I ask you, I'm sorry, Marcello, can I ask you, because of the demands of radio programming, we're going to take a break now. And yes, when we come back, we'll come back to your thinking about the difference between the Italians and the Swedes, and the difference between the Meloni government and the present Swedish government in fighting Russia on the Ukrainian battlefield. We'll come right back. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
We're more than a year away from the Democrat and Republican Party nominating conventions, but already people are starting to express concerns over what role AI might play in the election. Darrell West, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Technology Innovation, says it's going to be very difficult for voters to distinguish the real from the fake, and you can just imagine how either Trump supporters or Biden supporters could use this technology to make the opponent look bad. There could be things that drop right before the election that nobody has a chance to take down. Gee, you think? Let's just take a little lesson from our military, who decided to see what would happen if you tasked AI with conducting drone strikes against surface-to-air missile batteries. There was a human override failsafe that would instruct the drones not to engage a target, but the AI decided that because it identified a SAM battery, it should destroy the SAM battery, and therefore the human was the problem. Thankfully, the drones weren't armed, because the drones tried to take out the human that was sending it an override signal. Recognizing their quote-unquote programming error, they told the drones not to attack the human. So what did the drones do instead? They attacked the radio towers that were connecting the human to the drone. Sure, this technology can't get out of hand and cause any problems. No, not at all. AI needs to be regulated and regulated fast. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
According to the Caesar Rodney Election Research Institute, CRERI, 2020 election funding from Mark Zuckerberg's favored nonprofits, the Center for Technology and Civic Life, CTCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, had nothing to do with traditional campaign finance. It had to do with financing the infiltration of election offices at the city and county level by left-wing activists and using those offices as a platform to implement preferred administrative practices, voting methods, and data sharing agreements, as well as to launch intensive outreach campaigns in areas heavy with Democratic voters. In Wisconsin, an investigation uncovered that a left-wing activist connected to CTCL gained access to ballot rooms in Green Bay and helped determine how to handle ballots. CTCL agents in Georgia paid ballot counters and trained poll watchers. In Philadelphia, CTCL pushed the city to deploy ballot drop boxes, allowed for ballot curing unavailable to Republican counties, and even paid election judges, according to the Amistad Project.
War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
We're back. I'm sorry to say that George Eliason is still out of contact, but very happy to welcome back Marcello Ferrada de Noli, our guest speaking from both Sweden by knowledge and profession and academic work, and from Italy, where he's presently living and where he has long family roots. Marcello, you were comparing Italy and the Giorgia Meloni regime, which is pushing the NATO agenda against Italian resistance. In Sweden, if from my reading of the opinion polls and the political polls, the present centre-right government is doing far better at this war than the left. And if I'm looking at the current political lineup, I can see that the present government is the only line of public support which is rising, while all the left parties in Sweden, including the Social Democrats, if one calls them left, have been declining. So how do we explain that the opposition to war in Sweden seems to be losing traction, losing public support in Sweden, while gaining in Italy? You've mentioned the historical relationship between Sweden and Russia was an imperial one, in which Sweden lost its empire to Russia. Italy had its imperial ambitions to the south, as we all know, in Libya and Abyssinia and so forth, but failed to make it against the Russians in the north. What explains the difference in public opinion in political power?
You mentioned my professorship in Sweden as a possible source of understanding of what is going on in societal terms in that country or in Italy. Instead, I would benefit more of my professorship in philosophy I had in other latitudes, and with this going immediately to the concept of alienation. I believe that the alienation levels of the public of Sweden, respectively Italy, are differently and quantitatively and qualitatively. I mean, people disalienated with regard to reality. They do not receive the right information or sufficiently objective information in order to have an appraisal and therefore have an action towards their politicians. In Sweden, the situation is catastrophic in that sense. There is a freedom of expression, of course, but there is no possibility to express your opinion via the main papers, which are which responds to two main monopolies in Sweden, the Bonniers and the Skiftes. And what do we have in this mainstream media, particularly Dagens Nyheter? We have that the commentators of geopolitical affairs are, in their terms, emigres from Poland, which from the beginning had a distinct animosity against Russia. I mean, the Russia phobia permeated all or nearly all their comments and writings and the filtering of the information they're giving about Russia even before the conflict with Ukraine. We have I follow the newspapers in Sweden. I have been interviewed by newspapers in Sweden before, particularly, and they also been criticizing my positions, even in the field of epidemiology, just because, you know, when I mean, this is hilarious, but in a given moment, the only vaccine available in Europe was the Sputnik, because the other vaccines were not yet approved by the European Medicines Agency and so on. I proposed it in Italy to distribute I was going to buy a bunch of these vaccines to be distributed among the elderly population in the town where I live. It was going to be a gift from my part. But then I was criticized in Sweden, not in Italy. and then in one way or the other, they said that was, you know, that I was working against the interest of AstraZeneca, which is a company, a Swedish Anglo company. So the twisting of the happenings in the world, independent of are related to Ukraine or not, are immensely in Sweden. So what information the Swedish people is getting, you know, when the Swedish television, the state television, and then the newspapers, they are financed by the state to a certain percentage, not all. You have no possibility to counter arrest that kind of information.
I'm sorry to interrupt. What about the social media in Swedish? For example, the majority of our audience listening is American. The United States mainstream media are dominated in exactly the same way as you've described, and for much the same commercial and political reasons, yes, ideological reasons,
as in Sweden. Social media in the USA and Australia is much more...
No, not in Australia. I'm talking about the United States. Do you have anything comparable? The social media in the United States are the major platform for dissent and resistance to mainstream propaganda. Do you have such a thing in Sweden?
No. The answer is no, or not sufficiently. I know of only one or two sites, you know, that published articles or gave information about what is really going on in the war or in other spheres of the geopolitical conflict in the world. One of them is a geopolitical site led by a professor, also from the Karolinska, a retired professor whose name is Anders Romerfer. But it is not that developed in Sweden as it is in other countries, as it is in the United States, for instance, that you mentioned. So the other thing that I have to tell you, and this is very principal, very important, the decision that Sweden made, you know, to enter NATO, to apply for NATO membership, was not done by the Swedish people. You know, when Sweden entered the European Union, we had the referendum. Okay, when it was discussed the possibility of Sweden entering the euro system, it was a referendum. But when Sweden decided, you know, when the NATO lobby and the politicians decided to apply for the NATO membership, they did not call to a referendum. And what is the reason they gave for that? Yes, they say, well, if we call for a referendum, then we will have to open a public discussion. And if we open a public discussion, then there are possibilities that people in social media or et cetera, are going to influence, you know, the decision of the Swedish people. So openly stating that they were going to, from my perspective, that is a way of concealing the freedom of expression. So there you have that at the end that was voted in the Parliament of Sweden, the Riksdag, the Parliament of Sweden. In the Parliament of Sweden, many members of the Parliament were elected some years ago because of their position anti-NATO. Because, you know, that was very divided in Sweden. Just for 2 years ago, there was no majority among the population in the polls that were conducted in Sweden for a NATO membership. So several politicians, they made their in their platform, electoral platform, it was that they were for Sweden staying non-aligned, if not neutral. Okay. But those members of the parliament, you know, they did not respond. They did not follow their constituencies, and they voted for a NATO membership in a given moment. And it was not a vast majority either. But so you have that the political elites in Sweden decided for the Swedish membership of NATO. And the political elites and the cultural elites, and where you find them? Well, you find them that all those people, you know, are listening to the state television, they are reading Dagens Nyheter, Svenska Dagbladet, which, as I said already prior in this in my reply, they are having a dieted Russophobic agenda, and that was even before, as I said, of this the starting of the special military operation, and I want to also mention something that about the comparison between Italy and Sweden. Italy have not participated from the beginning in the experience in the Ukraine experience from 2014, but Sweden and Poland did. You know, when the putsch or the coup came to action in Kiev, that was supported by the Swedish foreign minister Carl Bildt. Openly, he was there, you know, in the middle of the Maidan movement, demonstration, etc., at exactly the same level as Nuland, you know, Victoria Nuland was, and also from distance, the foreign minister of Poland was also supporting that the coup, etc. So they were supporting even financially and very rapidly, militarily, the Ukrainian government earlier than any other European country I know. So Italy was not doing that. And as I said, Meloni is having that pro-Zelensky agenda, clearly, in my opinion, supported by her own party, which is a far-right party, the Fratelli d'Italia and others. But the majority of Italians, they do not support that sending of arms. They support sending of humanitarian help, but not sending of weapons. And that is about the 80%. So I'm not talking about a little majority.
Marcello, we're running out of time. I'm very sorry to say we could spend very profitably much more time. But in the 60 seconds or so we've got left, do you personally feel thinking and writing and broadcasting your convictions as you do, do you feel are comfortable in Sweden as compared to Italy? Do you feel under pressure, under ostracism? Do you still feel free in Stockholm?
Sweden, as well as Italy, are part of the European Union. And European Union, it is rapidly and forcible having, you know, positions against the free expression, commenting issues of war, geopolitical issues in general, etc. I do not feel more comfortable or less comfortable in Sweden, Italy, or for that part, in any country of the European Union. Because
Marcello, thank you very much for that. I'm sorry to cut you off. We have to stop. It's been Marcello Bradadinoli and John Helmer minus Georgia Larson on War of the Worlds. See you next week.